ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He's worth more than $1 billion. Christopher Skase buys Warwick Capa for the Brisbane Bears.
He paid me the most cash because I was the best player.
But
Skase was essentially a hustler and a huckster.
And he gets away with the biggest corporate crash in Australia. I'm Mark Humphreys. Search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dr. Michael Braby clicked open the attachment to his email and was instantly curious by the picture that stared back at him. It was of a creature with dark brown wings and a creamy underbelly with streaks of black and orange. It was a butterfly. Now, most people wouldn't have noticed anything strange about this, but Dr. Michael Braby, you see, he's a butterfly collector and he instantly zoomed in on the photo, utterly puzzled because something wasn't right. The label looked correct, but there was something about the butterfly's markings.
But when Braby looked at this butterfly, and particularly the red markings, they didn't look legit. They looked like they'd been painted on, dolled up, to be an imposter.
And indeed, it was. But who would fake a butterfly?
For perhaps 70 years, it had been sitting in this museum collection and no one had discovered it until Michael Braby came along and realised that it was probably connected to this butterfly heist back in the 1940s.
My name is Mark Fennell, and this is the story of how a mysterious gentleman duped Australian museums and stole thousands of butterflies right under their noses. And at the time, no one saw it coming.
So I've always been kind of drawn to museums because they are these places where we can come face to face, you know, it's right behind glass and we're looking at this physical manifestation of the past. And sometimes that means, you know, it's rocks that have fallen from space. Sometimes it means, you know, a stuffed extinct marsupial. Sometimes it's like a bronze treasure that was looted in a colonial conquest.
I do love a looted artifact story, and this one is a roller coaster.
And so, yeah, it puts us in conversation with the past and the present. And so it's always been really interesting to me.
So this is Walter Marsh.
I'm a journalist and an editor and a historian based here in Adelaide on Kaurna land.
As a child, Walter used to visit the South Australian Museum in Adelaide. And then, as an adult, he got a job there. And very quickly, a co-worker at the museum, she asks Walter if he'd heard about the stolen butterflies.
And I was pretty much hooked right away because this story just seemed like the perfect sort of spine to explore those twisted and complicated histories from the past.
So what was this mystery? Well, it all begins with a gentleman.
Colin William Ford Wyatt. He's born in London in 1909. He's kind of born into this family that in earlier centuries was a famous architectural dynasty. You know, he has ancestors, relatives who were the architects of choice for British royalty and the rich and the powerful. And by the time Colin comes along, his father, James Wyatt, he's already an accomplished mountaineer, skier, and perhaps most importantly, a butterfly collector. And so Colin spends his childhood sort of going back and forth between home in England and these Swiss chalets and skiing villages and all these countries around Europe, following his father and his mother on their sort of adventures.
Between all the travel and the skiing, young Colin starts to become obsessed with nature, specifically one very beautiful, very mysterious part of nature's kingdom.
So from, I think he was maybe 6 years old when he first is taught how to pin, collect and display butterflies. And from there, he pretty much takes to that hobby. He starts collecting caterpillars and raising them in his childhood bedroom and pretty soon starts building up this collection that he would continue to build and grow for his entire life. And by the end of his life, it was, I think, something like 90,000 butterflies he'd collected.
Did you ever get a sense of why? Like, what is it about the collecting of butterflies that tickled something for him?
Yeah, he kind of describes it as there's this ineffable thrill that he gets. You can't quite describe it. It's sort of inexplicable. He kind of describes himself as a sort of Lepidopteran Sherlock Holmes, where he'll, you know, he'll drop himself into this new country, this new landscape, and he'll, you know, read the topography of the landscape. He'll look at the foliage and he'll start deducing. He'll use his instincts, use his knowledge to track down, yeah, not the criminal, but the butterfly that he's after.
I wonder if he ever had the Sherlock Holmes hat. Like, I feel like a deer stalker when you're stalking butterflies feels somehow appropriate in my mind. I don't know why.
I've seen him in a pith helmet.
That'll do. I mean, the interesting thing about Colin is he has a whole bunch of hobbies, right? Because he's like a champion skier at he starts skiing at 3, right?
Yeah, so he you know, he's barely walking by the time his father starts teaching him how to ski. And pretty much by the time Colin hits adulthood, all those steps that his father had taken to train him from boyhood have pretty much paid off. And he emerges into adulthood as this dashing champion skier, this naturalist, this collector.
Yeah, can we not bury the yodeling, though? Because he's also a yodeler, right?
Yeah, well, that kind of ties back to this childhood that he spent sort of going back and forth between England and Europe. And he would tell people later in life that he was basically raised in Europe, and he'd picked up all these Norwegian and Swiss folk songs, this yodeling technique, and all these languages, and, of course, the piano accordion.
Okay, so Colin is an adventurer. He's a sort of Renaissance man, an athlete. He's traveling around Europe. But then somehow he finds himself in the South Pacific. How does that happen?
So in 1935, he accepts an invitation to come down to New Zealand to go on this kind of ski tour and show them how to build up their own ski tourism industry. And pretty much as soon as he touches down, he starts breaking records. He starts climbing mountains that haven't been climbed by any white man before, and leaving this incredible impression wherever he goes.
And from the sounds of it, he cut quite a figure.
He's often described as kind of this prototypical English gentleman adventurer. He's got this ginger hair. He's got this moustache. He's got charisma. He's got panache. You know, even people who later think he's a sort of, you know, a fraud or even a thief, even they have to admit he is really good company.
Around 1937, Colin wraps up his New Zealand skiing tour and makes his way back home to the United Kingdom. But soon he makes a decision. He's going to move to Australia with a very special someone.
He announces that he's getting engaged, and it makes a real splash across all these newspapers and society magazines that he's already been appearing in. Mary Scott Barrett, she's about 10 years his junior. She's barely into her 20s when they get engaged, and pretty quickly they get married and she uproots her life to start afresh in Australia. And she becomes his, you know, as they said in the papers, his pretty wife. And they become kind of staples of Sydney society. They're pictured in all the gossip pages. They're always popping up having dinner at these fancy restaurants, even as war's breaking out.
During the war, Colin gets a job as a camouflage artist, which is basically what it says on the box. It's literally designing camouflage for armed forces. Because alongside the accordion and the butterfly collecting, Colin's a bit of a budding artist.
And so it's this weird kind of civilian movement where a lot of artists, a lot of famous artists are involved. And once war breaks out, they kind of get brought inside the tent. They become an official arm of the Department of Home Security. And they recruit some pretty big names, become camouflage officers. People like the photographer Max Dupain is among them. People who basically felt that, you know, if they were going to die in this war, if they're going to be conscripted, they might as well do it with a camera or a paintbrush in their hand rather than a rifle. And so it's a little surprise that Colin Wyatt joins their ranks. And so he spends a lot of time during the Second World War traveling up and down the coast, working on these camouflage projects, but also going up to New Guinea, where he's kind of exposed to the realities of war at that front line.
There is something kind of perfect, I must say, just listening to you talk about the fact that he's got this obsession with butterflies, who are masters of camouflage, while he's working as this camouflage artist, the camoufleur. Like, there's something just poetically perfect about that, right?
Absolutely. There's this book called The Art of Camouflage that this camouflage society put out, and they describe all the perfect characteristics of a camouflage artist. And it's, you know, a knowledge of painting, a knowledge of the natural landscape, an understanding of the animal kingdom, and this knack for kind of improvisation. And Colin ticks all those boxes, and so he immediately becomes this camouflage officer and ships out.
And it is around this time that Colin and Mary's marriage, hits the rocks.
And finally, by November 1946, that divorce finally goes through.
So 1946 is an important year because there are some very unusual museum visits that Colin makes that year. Tell me what happens.
Yeah, so pretty much as soon as he arrives in Australia, he starts making these connections to Australia's butterfly collecting community in Sydney and in Melbourne. He starts reaching out and befriending entomologists up and down the country. And one of them was a man named Dr. Athol Waterhouse.
So this Waterhouse fellow is actually quite a big deal. He had been the president of the Australian Museum and he'd literally written the book on Australian butterflies.
And it's his collection, his life's work, that he donated to the Australian Museum, and their butterfly collection is largely his butterfly collection. And so Colin befriends him. They go out on a few collecting trips together and he winds up with a letter of introduction from the famous Dr. Athol Waterhouse. And he uses this to introduce himself to museums in Sydney and in Melbourne. And they basically, you know, they welcome him in because that's how these places work.
A lot of these museums, they open their doors to collectors and amateur scientists like Wyatt to inspect specimens, to compare notes. And sort of in the background is this idea that they might donate their own collections to the museum one day.
It's kind of the whole point of the system is this noble idea of the museum collections. You know, they eventually outlive any one collector, any one person, and they create this bigger collection of knowledge bundled up in all of these labels with all of these collectors' names. It's also kind of their biography being told across these collections. It tells you exactly where they went, when they went there, what they found, and who they knew. And so the act of giving over your collection to these museums is very generous, but it's also a way to kind of have your name outlive you.
So Colin's gone around with this letter from Waterhouse, which, as you can imagine, is just like opening up the doors to museums and collections, and everything seems above board, at least for a while.
So at the time, you know, he is just another collector. He comes into these places, he has a look at their collections, he goes out on collecting trips with other entomologists, and it's only once the separation with Mary is finalized and he packs up his life in Sydney and goes back to the UK that the entomologists of Australia, that Australia's museums, notice that anything's out of place and that he might have been up to maybe something else while he was paying visits.
One morning in January 1947, an entomologist goes down into the basement of the National Museum of Victoria in Melbourne.
This sort of dark, cold labyrinth of a basement with all these storerooms where they hold all the collections that are on display upstairs. And he goes into the entomology room and he pulls out a drawer. It's all routine until he sees three empty gaps in that drawer. He starts to think maybe that's not quite right, but he pulls out another drawer and then another drawer. And then another, and he keeps seeing these little gaps. And so he pulls out a drawer full of Ulysses butterflies that he knows is for sure chock full of bright blue, big, beautiful butterflies.
I think you can guess what he saw.
It's got gaps as well. And now the alarm bells are ringing. Pretty soon he does a full audit of the entire collection. And there are over 800 butterflies missing from the National Museum of Victoria's entomology collection. And that's just the start.
And the thing is, these gaps in the drawers, they're not random. Whoever took these butterflies has very carefully selected them.
So immediately they think this is a very deliberate act by someone who knows their way around a museum collection, knows their way around Australian butterflies.
And just like that, the museum phones start to run hot.
You know, there's this flurry of activity all around the country as entomologists are checking their collections. By the time the Australian Museum and the South Australian Museum have finished checking their collections, that tally that started with, you know, three gaps in a drawer, it's now well over 3,000 specimens, and many of them are rare holotypes.
So this is a major problem, right? Because the holotype is the first specimen of a species. So thinking of it like the source material. It's what the name and the description is based on. So if any scientist wants to look at whether a species has, you know, changed in any way over the years, they go off the holotype. That's what they're comparing all butterflies to. So the fact that those holotypes are missing, well, that, my friends, is not ideal. But who, you might be wondering, is suspected of taking these butterflies out of these museum collections?
So the list of suspects is very short. So in Sydney and Melbourne, at least, you know, he has not kept a low profile.
There was even one occasion where he was caught red-handed in the Melbourne Museum, but somehow got away with it.
Apparently the treasurer of the museum had actually poked his head into the entomologist's room in December 1946. This is the same room where the butterflies were later found to have been missing. And he walked in on this stranger, this man he didn't know, who was looking through the drawers of butterflies. But he didn't raise the alarm. He didn't really ask who this guy was. Partly because, firstly, the guy seemed to know a lot about insects, but also because, and this is a direct quote, he spoke well and with a rather cultured accent. As you know, someone with a cultured accent, they couldn't possibly be up to anything dodgy.
No.
So the treasurer of the museum caught him basically in the act and left him be because he seemed legit, like he belonged there.
He's too posh to be a thief.
Exactly.
So the list of suspects is short. What happens next?
So, yeah, by the time he's identified as a potential culprit, Colin White has already packed up his life in Australia. He's made his way back to England. He's also shipped these cases of butterfly specimens back to his mother's house in Surrey. And so they enlist the help of the London Natural History Museum. And this is where the story gets even more bizarre, because when they reach out to their counterparts in London, it turns out the name Colin White is already very familiar to the staff of that museum.
He'd actually been banned from London's Natural History Museum.
And it turns out that a few years earlier, in 1942, no less than Dr. Athol Waterhouse himself, Colin White's one-time friend, he had started to suspect that maybe his new pal wasn't everything he was cracked up to be. And so Waterhouse, he writes this letter to a friend who worked at the London Museum, and he very casually drops Wyatt's name. Almost immediately he gets a telegram from the head entomologist at the Natural History Museum that reads in all caps, "Do not trust. This man has collector's mania and is not to be trusted with specimens." A few weeks after the butterflies are discovered missing in Melbourne, there's this detective from Scotland Yard and that head entomologist from Natural History Museum in London. They catch a train, they go out to Colin White's mother's house in Surrey, and they knock on his mother's door. And Colin's there. The entomologist has this list of stolen butterflies from Melbourne. Colin has these crate loads of butterflies that he's just had shipped over from Australia. And initially he tries to deny it, denies knowing anything about the stolen butterflies, but eventually he caves and tells them, yeah, I stole them. And this, he gives this very brief confession, and he says that basically, firstly, it was all because of the breakup of his marriage. He says, "I was driven to distraction over this matter, so I threw myself into my only hobby, namely entomology."
I mean, as divorce coping strategies go, I've definitely heard worse. Some people drink or do drugs or take up blackjack. Colin went on a butterfly bender. But the thing is, for Wyatt, this is an obsession. Like, to him, a rare butterfly was as valuable as a rare diamond. And it turns out the way he stole the specimens was criminally simple.
He would slip the specimens into small jars that he would then hide in, you know, the pockets of his jacket and then just walk out the door. So physically taking hundreds and hundreds of them out of these museum spaces without anyone noticing that anything seemed suspicious, it's this astonishing feat. But, you know, from the museum's perspective, I think the more questions you ask about how he pulled that off, you know, the more unflattering the revelation becomes. So at some point, you know, they stop asking questions and they just move on to the priority becomes recovering the specimens and trying to get some sort of semblance of justice.
Ultimately, Wyatt surrenders the butterflies so they can be sent back to Australia and returned to their museums. But remember, it's not just about the butterflies. It's those labels, that catalogue of information they carry with them about who collected them, where from, and when. It seems Wyatt deliberately messed with those labels.
Wyatt has apparently mucked with the labels. He changed the labels. He made new ones to make it seem like he had gone to all these places and collected them himself, which in many ways was geographically impossible to have been all these places. This was multiple life's works of multiple collectors, and he was trying to create this alternate paper trail that suggested he had managed to do it in the few short years he'd been in Australia, which infuriated and bewildered the museum entomologists, because the data on the specimens, like, that's the whole point. The labels are the whole point.
This is, I think, the really important part of this story, right? Because on the one hand, this could just be an ephemeral story of an incredibly weird guy with a weird hobby, series of weird hobbies, who just stole some stuff for his own amusement, right? But it's the chaos that ensues, the scientific chaos that ensues from him relabeling everything that actually we are still, to some extent, living with the legacy of now.
Absolutely. And so by the time these butterflies come back to Australia, they come back to Adelaide and at the South Australian Museum, all these entomologists descend to try and make sense of this recovered collection. And they find the same thing that the people back in England did, that all these labels have been changed. You know, it's basically guesswork, but they try and figure out what butterflies came from where. But it's really, you know, it's kind of impossible to know in many instances.
And one final crushing blow to this story. Remember Athol Waterhouse, the man whose letter of introduction just like opened museum doors for Colin Wyatt in the first place? Well, apart from the fact that his trust in Wyatt completely backfired on him, it was Waterhouse's labels that were among those that Wyatt tampered with.
Colin Wyatt uses his own name, Waterhouse's own name, to gain access to these collections to steal butterflies that included Waterhouse's own life's work. And so the idea that a collector might tamper with those collections, there's something very kind of transgressive about that.
What do you think the legacy of Colin Wyatt should be? Like, because he's obviously a fun character to talk about, but what do you reckon he actually changes about our world?
Well, for me, when I first heard the story and how he pulled off these heists, the fact that he was able to walk and talk his way into these places to arouse no suspicion, it says a lot about the values that these places were built on. Because on so many levels, it's true that these museums, these collections, they were created by generations of gentlemen collectors and naturalists that looked and sounded, that had cultured accents just like Colin Wyatt.
I mean, those are the building blocks of Western museums. It's how they get started.
Exactly. And the fact that he fit right in and then robbed them blind, it says a lot about, I think, the museums themselves. It's kind of, you know, in the last few decades, we've seen that those values, that those hierarchies of race and class and privilege that gave men like Colin Wyatt this sort of golden ticket through life, that gave Western gentlemen adventurers and explorers in that golden age that Colin Wyatt grew up on, that gave them that sense of entitlement, that gave them the obligation to round up, to possess, to collect, to catalogue the world and bring it back to our museums. And ultimately, I think it shows that museums were kind of the alibi and the accessory to this age of empire. And when we walk through those halls, as I so often do, it's hard not to think, you know, that they're kind of like crime scenes for the worst excesses of that process. And, you know, I talk about looking at these drawers of butterflies with little yellow labels peeking out. Sometimes when I walk through a museum collection, a public gallery, I can't help but think, you know, what if there were little yellow labels on everything with a questionable origin story that maybe, you know, belongs in a theft collection?
To this day, those little yellow tags, the ones he's referring to, they're attached to butterflies, reading Pass Through C.W. Wyatt Theft Collection, 1946 to 1947. So they're a warning that this label, this butterfly, the information with it can never truly be trusted. Some of them were even painted to look like different species, which is what Dr. Michael Braby from the beginning of this episode uncovered. There's layers of theft to this story. As for the man himself, in 1975, Colin Wyatt was chasing more nature in Guatemala when his plane went down.
And so Colin ultimately dies in pursuit of that kind of life of adventure. And his collection of 90,000 specimens, that goes to a museum, which I think is kind of fitting.
It sure is. Walter, thank you so much for telling us the story of the butterfly thief.
Thanks for having me.
Walter Marsh is a journalist and author. His new book is called The Butterfly Thief: Adventure, Empire, and Australia's Greatest Museum Heist. This episode of No One Saw It Coming was produced by Taryn Priadko and Zoe Ferguson on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. The sound design was by Angie Grant. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you check out all of the other episodes. You can listen on the ABC Listen app or, frankly, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a story or an idea about a forgotten part of history that you'd like us to investigate, all you need to do, you know it's coming, all you need to do is email us. noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. I'm Mark Fennell. I will be back with a brand new episode next week. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.